Terror Network through the Office to Combat Terrorism, OCT. Working through the NSC's operations subgroup, North coordinated the back-channel CT network with Major General Richard Secord's off-the-shelf enterprise in a series of illegal operations. Among them were Israel's facilitation of arms sales to Iran, American civilians supplying arms to the Contras, and Contra drug smuggling into America. North also planned for the repression of domestic dissent and criticism. As P.D. Scott has noted, the Office to Combat Terrorism became the means whereby North could coordinate the propaganda activities of Carl Spitz, Channel, and Richard Miller, and the closing of potential embarrassing investigations by other government agencies. The evolution climaxed in 1986 with the creation of the Counter-Terror Center under Dwayne Claridge. Yet another right-wing ideologue, Claridge had been chief of the CIA's station in Turkey in the late 1960s and early 1970s, when the fascist Grey Wolves went on a terror rampage, bombing and killing thousands of public officials, journalists, students, lawyers, labor organizers, social democrats, left-wing activists, and Kurds. Since then, Turkey's military has been one of America's strongest allies, despite the recent coup attempt staged by the American-based CIA-connected exile Fethullah Gulen. A bodybuilder and scion of the old boy clique that runs the CIA, Claridge was chief of Latin America Division from 1981 until 1984, when Nicaraguan harbors were mined and the CIA's murder manual was distributed to the Contras. Claridge helped Secord's off-the-shelf enterprise move PLO weapons captured by Israeli forces during their bloody invasion of Lebanon through Manuel Noriega in Panama to the Contras. That's the kind of stuff the CT Center still does today, moving weapons from chaotic places like Benghazi in Libya to deniable terrorist surrogates in Syria. As chief of the Europe Division, Claridge had also provided the back channel in Lisbon that Secord's enterprise used to sell Hawk and TOW missiles to the Iranians in exchange for the release of American hostages. According to Scott, the intrigues of North, Secord, Claridge, and Robert Oakley at the State Department at this point showed a concern for politics rather than security. When I interviewed him, Claridge described the CT Center, which has coordinated CIA back-channel activities since 1986, as a central unit with members from the directorates operating under a committee at the National Security Council. With input from the division chiefs, the CT Center divines, as he put it, anti-terrorism policy, and then constructs entities that conduct operations. It is not a function of U.S. Special Forces, as often portrayed in the media, but of CIA action teams trained to capture suspected terrorists and bring them to the United States to stand trial. During his tenure as CT Center Chief from 1986 to 1988, Claridge worked directly with George H.W. Bush. He was lucky in that regard. Claridge was indicted on 7 counts of lying to Congress, but his case never went to trial, thanks to a last-minute pardon Bush issued on 24 December 1992. When called to task about his crimes, North blamed the peaceniks who lost the Vietnam War. If liberal politicians hadn't investigated the CIA, he argued, then fascists like him wouldn't have had to resort to dirty tricks. North's hatred of the peace movement was palpable. North believed that the most pressing problem is not in the Third World, but here at home in the struggle for the minds of the people. North was out of control. When Jack Turrell told the Justice Department that North was involved in Contra drug smuggling, North labeled Turrell a terrorist and sicked the FBI on him. But neither North nor any of the other Iran-Contra criminals were ever punished because, as Michael McClintock noted at the time, the very notion of counter-terror as terrorism was forbidden, while circumlocution was the norm. That's how the CIA's CT Center evolved from the chaos domestic spying mechanism into the nerve center of the CIA's clandestine staff. Same thing happened with the CIA's counter-narcotics center at the same time. Both are modeled on Phoenix, and both are wonderful tools for White House cadres to exercise political control over the bureaucracies they coordinate. These centers are the perfect means for policing and expanding the empire. They make it easier than ever for the CIA to track people and events in every corner of the world. The need for the old-fashioned directorates is fading away. You don't need an entire directorate to understand the political, social, and economic movements around the world anymore, because the United States is controlling them all. The U.S. has color revolutions going everywhere. It's got the World Bank and the IMF strangling countries with debt, like the banks are strangling college students and homeowners here. The war on terror is the best thing that ever happened to U.S. capitalists and their secret police force, the CIA. Terrorism is the pretext that allows the CIA to coordinate and transcend every government agency and civic institution, including the media, to the extent that we don't even see its wars anymore. Its control is so pervasive, so ubiquitous, the CIA has actually become the Phoenix. Jimenez, right. Valentine. It's the eye of God in the sky. It's able to determine what's going to happen next because it's controlling all of these political, social, and economic movements. It pits the Sunnis against the Shiites. It doesn't need slow and outdated directorates. These Phoenix centers enable it to determine events instantaneously anywhere. There are now counter-terror intelligence centers all over the world. In Phoenix, they were called Intelligence Operations Coordinating Centers. So it's basically exactly the same thing. It's been evolving that way, and everybody on the inside was gearing themselves for this glorious moment for 30 years. They even have a new staff position called Targeting Officers. You can Google this. Jimenez, right, exactly. Valentine, the centers represent the unification of military intelligence and media operations under political control. White House political appointees oversee them, but the determinant force is the CIA careerists who slither into private industry when their careers are over. They form the consulting firms that direct the corporations that drive the empire. Through their informal old boy network, the CIA guys and gals keep America at war so they can make $1 million when their civil service career is over. Jimenez. The Washington Post and subsequent articles frame it as if these changes are drastic. But to hear you, it's a natural progression. So what does this announcement mean? Is the CIA putting out their own press release through the Washington Post just to give everyone the heads up? Valentine. Well, everybody in the CIA was worried that if the directorates were reorganized, it would negatively affect their careers. But executive management usually does what its political bosses tell them to do, and Brennan reorganized in 2015. He created a fifth directorate, the Directorate for Digital Innovation, DDI, ostensibly as the CIA's mantelpiece. But as the Washington Times reported, it is the formation of the new mission centers, including ones for counterintelligence, weapons and counterproliferation, and counterterrorism, that is most likely to shake up the agency's personnel around the world. The CIA's 10 new mission centers are designed to serve as locations to integrate capabilities and bring the full range of CIA's operational, analytic, support, technical and digital skill sets to bear against the nation's most pressing national security problems. This modernization means the CIA is better able to control people politically, starting with its own officers, than everyone else. That's the ultimate goal. Politicians, speaking in a unified voice, create the illusion of a crime-fighting CIA and an America with a responsibility to protect benighted foreigners from themselves. But they can't tell you what the CIA does, because it's all illegal. Well, it's all a lie. In order for the politicians to hold office, they have to cover for the CIA. Their concern is how to explain the reorganization and exploit it. They squabble among themselves and cut the best deals possible. Jimenez, that makes complete sense. Talking about all the illegal activity the CIA is involved in, I couldn't help but think of the drug running. I'd like to point out to our listeners the article you wrote, which offers everything they ought to know as far as the history of the CIA and drugs. It's entitled The CIA and Drugs, A Covert History, Counterpunch, 7 November 2014. Meanwhile, I'd like to hear your opinion on the influence of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency tactics in local law enforcement. Local police departments are adopting many of the same tactics. We're seeing the U.S. government use counterterrorism and counterinsurgency tactics against its own people. Perhaps one of the most vivid examples is what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. Is that, too, a natural progression of Phoenix? Valentine. Absolutely. The very last paragraph in my book, The Phoenix Program, says you'll know the Phoenix has arrived when you start seeing police forces advancing on protesters in paramilitary formations and driving around in armored vehicles. That's what the CIA does in foreign nations. It militarizes police forces so it can control that country's political, economic, and social movements. The CIA's influence is pervasive here, too. It advises all the major police departments in the U.S. The Phoenix model of coordinating agencies happens under the cognizance of the CIA because the premier threat is a terrorist infiltrating the U.S. with nukes. It goes back to chaos thinking. Maybe ISIS is recruiting black radicals in Ferguson. If so, we need paramilitary police forces and administrative detention laws to neutralize them. The Missouri governor can say a protester in Ferguson is violating national security laws and hold him indefinitely. The media loves it. Fox News said that Black Lives protesters were holding us, meaning white people, hostage. If it's a hostage situation, they're terrorists. Tucker Carlson said, I paraphrase, "You can talk about race all you want. It's a hostage situation, and race doesn't matter." So the racists in government and law enforcement are elated. Now they can send in provocateurs, maybe an Afghanistan veteran like Dallas shooter Micah Johnson, who got wiped out by a robot carrying a Claymore mine, and start riots and crush the protesters because they're terrorists. And that's how, over the last 40 years, dissent has come to equal terrorism. It's how the 1% wants us to see nonviolent protest. They want the public to believe that anybody who resists law enforcement is a terrorist. All the pieces have been put in place through the corporate media to make the lies seem true. These counter-terror intelligence centers are already operating in the United States through the Department of Homeland Security's fusion centers, which do the same thing. Jimenez, exactly. Valentine. The American empire consists of hundreds of military bases and a CIA station in every country. It's Pepsi being sold in Vietnam. We are the world. It's not just 50 states and a few protectorates. It's crazy for average Americans to think their fate is not directly connected to the fate of every other person in the world, or that the 1% considers them higher class peasants than the other worker bees elsewhere around the world. There are diminishing resources and other strategic problems that the CIA is forecasting 20 years into the future. It's planning stratospheric aerosol injections to cure climate change. The reorganization of the CIA is another incremental step in anticipation of America reaching that tipping point. Gated communities are the future. The centers replicate them. Jimenez. Indeed. Something you said just now really struck me. And that's the way that Americans separate themselves from the other. It reminds me of these arguments we hear in the media regarding the use of militarized police. It's okay in Afghanistan, but not in Ferguson. The use of predator drones to kill somebody in Yemen is okay, but not in Montana. It's murder either way. But most of the American public doesn't see it that way. We can discuss this, but unless the American people do something to change this, then we run the risk of these things just becoming normal and accepted. For example, the CIA's drug running, now we see in feature films, in Hollywood productions. Valentine. They think, well, that's what the CIA does. Everybody knows it. If you watch a pro football game, you know the U.S. military owns the NFL. There's F-14s flying over the stadiums. Every spectator has to stand and salute and plant a big wet kiss on the military's fat, bloated butt. In my opinion, what it will take is for the men and women in the military to realize they're part of a self-defeating enterprise. Before you can change the CIA, you have to change some other things. You have to shrink the military establishment and end the war on drugs, which can be done. When given the chance in state referendums, people are voting for medical marijuana and adult recreational use. When given a chance to vote, people express common sense. Marijuana is not going to make you go out and massacre school kids or abortion providers. That happens because we live in a country that glorifies the god of violence and his sacred warriors. Demilitarizing American society is a start, like decriminalizing marijuana is a first step in ending the war on drugs. It's easier than challenging an arcane thing like the CIA that's covered with gray and black propaganda. It's hard for people to understand how huge bureaucratic systems work together. They get frustrated and vote to leave the European Union, or they cling to Trump or Clinton, thinking things will change. Maybe next year all the students will default on their loans and bring the system down. Maybe they'll say, to hell with the bankers for mortgaging my future. We're taking it back. If something like that can happen, if that kind of consciousness can spread among young people being held in economic bondage and groomed to administer the empire, then there's hope. If they see they have nothing to lose, they'll come together and start making a fuss. Jimenez, that would be something to behold. Valentine, you have to use your imagination. Part 2. How the CIA co-opted and manages the war on drugs. The whole history of spectacular society called for the Secret Services to play the pivotal role, because it is in them that the characteristics and means of execution of such a society are concentrated to the highest degree. Guy Debord, Comments on the Society of the Spectacle. Chapter 12. Creating a Crime. How the CIA commandeered the Drug Enforcement Administration. The outlawing of narcotic drugs at the start of the 20th century coincided with Secretary of State John Hay's open-door policy toward China. This is one of the ironies of American history, given that the open-door policy originated with Great Britain's first opium war, 1839 to 1842, against China. At the time, the British insisted that free trade civilized the world by making it wealthier. Free trade, they said, gave them the divine right to push Indian opium on China in exchange for tea. They shared this principle with Confederate Americans who fought for their right to own slaves. America's open-door policy placed it in competition with the world's other imperial powers. From that point on, the federal government was committed to maintain, through military might, open markets in every nation in the world on behalf of American businesses. Not coincidentally, the outlawing of narcotic drugs turned the issue of addiction from a matter of public health into a pretext for expanding police forces and reorganizing the criminal justice and social welfare systems. The new healthcare industry was placed in the hands of businessmen seeking profits at the expense of despised minorities, the poor, and working classes. Private businesses established civic institutions to sanctify this policy. Public educators developed curriculums that doubled as political indoctrination, promoting the business party line. Bureaucracies were established to promote the expansion of corporate interests abroad, while suppressing resistance to the oligarchy that benefited from it. It takes a library full of books to explain the economic foundations of the war on drugs and the reasons for America's laissez-faire regulation of its medical, pharmaceutical, and drug manufacturing industries. Suffice it to say that investors used the government to unleash and transform their economic power into political and military might. And by World War II, the free trade world was relying on the United States for its opium derivatives under the guardianship of Harry Anslinger, the commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, FBN. Narcotic drugs are a strategic resource. And when Anslinger learned that Peru had built a cocaine factory, he unilaterally confiscated its stash before it could be sold to Germany or Japan. In another instance, Anslinger and his counterpart at the State Department prevented a drug manufacturer in Argentina from selling drugs to Germany. At the same time, according to Douglas Clark Kinder, Anslinger permitted an American company to ship drugs to Southeast Asia despite receiving intelligence reports that French authorities were permitting opiate smuggling into China and collaborating with Japanese drug traffickers. Federal drug law enforcement's relationship with the espionage establishment matured with the creation of the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. Prior to World War II, the FBN was the government agency most adept at conducting covert operations at home and abroad. As a result, OSS Chief William Donovan asked his friend Harry Anslinger to provide senior FBN agents to help organize the OSS. FBN agents trained OSS agents to manage agent networks, engage in sabotage and subversion, and work undercover to avoid security forces in hostile nations. The relationship grew during the war when FBN executives and agents assisted OSS scientists in truth drug experiments involving marijuana. The extra-legal nature of the relationship continued after the war, when the CIA decided to test LSD on unsuspecting American citizens. FBN agents were chosen to operate the CIA safe houses where the experiments were conducted. The relationship was formalized overseas in 1951 when agent Charlie Siragusa opened an office in Rome and began to develop the FBN's foreign operations. In the 1950s, FBN agents posted overseas spent half their time doing favors for the CIA, such as investigating diversions of strategic materials and Marshall Plan largesse behind the Iron Curtain. A handful of FBN agents were actually recruited into the CIA while maintaining their FBN credentials as cover. Officially, FBN agents set limits. Siragusa, for example, claimed to object when the CIA asked him to mount a controlled delivery into the U.S. as a way of identifying the American members of a smuggling ring with communist affiliations. In his autobiography, Siragusa said, "The FBN could never knowingly allow 2 pounds of heroin to be delivered into the United States and be pushed to mafia customers in the New York City area, even if in the long run we could seize a bigger haul." In 1960, the CIA asked Siragusa to recruit assassins from his stable of underworld contacts. Siragusa again claimed to have refused. But mafia drug traffickers, including most prominently Santo Trafficante Jr., were soon participating in CIA attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro. Siragusa did open a CIA safe house in 1960. FBN agents in New York maintained the MK Ultra pad and used it to make cases and debrief informants. When the CIA wanted to use the pad, it would call the district supervisor in New York City and tell him to keep the agents away for a few days. FBN agent Arthur Fleur served as New York District Supervisor George Belk's administrative assistant from 1963 to 1968. As Fleur recalled, "Belk was given a CIA contract. George said that he never actually met anyone from the CIA, but that Siragusa told him to cooperate if and when he was contacted. Later, the CIA did call. They told Belk, 'You'll have this checking account, but don't write any checks other than for rent and the maintenance of the 13th Street apartment.'" The CIA used Belk's account, which at times held $1 million and at other times was empty, as a slush fund for foreign officials on its payroll. "Sometimes we were told to babysit people for the CIA while they were in town," Fleur said. "One time it was a group of Burmese generals. They came for a few days, and when they weren't at the UN, they used the money in Belk's account to go on a shopping spree. They went down to the electronics shops on Canal Street and filled suitcases full of stuff." The CIA chaperoned the visiting Burmese generals through customs without their bags being checked. One can imagine what they brought into New York City in those same suitcases. The CIA used the safe houses to conduct all manner of illegal domestic operations behind the FBI's back. Indeed, in the course of investigating illegal FBI wiretaps in January 1967, Senator Edward Long learned that the FBN was managing the CIA's safe houses. No one in Congress knew about it. Treasury officials held meetings with the CIA's Assistant Deputy Director of Plans, Desmond Fitzgerald, and MK Ultra boss Sid Gottlieb. After a few days of dissembling, Gottlieb admitted that the CIA had used the pads to obtain information, which was of obvious interest to us in connection with our own investigative work. That particular pad was shut down. We gave the furniture to the Salvation Army, Fleur recalled, and took the drapes off the windows and put them up in our office. And FBN agent Andrew Tartolino opened a more luxurious CIA safe house on Sutton Place. As the dominant partner in the relationship, the CIA exploited its affinity with the FBN. Like the CIA, FBN agent Robert DeFaw explained, narcotics agents mount covert operations. We pose as members of the narcotics trade. The big difference is that we're in foreign countries legally, and through our police and intelligence sources, we can check out just about anyone or anything. Not only that, we're operational, so the CIA jumped in our stirrups. Jumping into the FBN's stirrups afforded the CIA deniability. To further ensure that the CIA's criminal activities are not revealed to the public, narcotics agents are organized militarily within the sacred chain of command. Highly indoctrinated, they blindly obey on a need-to-know basis. This institutionalized ignorance sustains the illusion of American righteousness in the name of national security, upon which their motivation to commit all manner of crimes depends. But as FBN agent Martin Pera explained, if you're successful because you can lie, cheat, and steal, those things become tools you use in the bureaucracy. Institutionalized corruption originated at headquarters in Washington, where FBN executives provided cover for CIA assets engaged in drug trafficking. In 1966, Agent John Evans was assigned as an assistant to FBN Enforcement Chief John Enright. And that's when I got to see what the CIA was doing, Evans told me. I saw a report on the Kuomintang saying they were the biggest drug dealers in the world and that the CIA was underwriting them. Air America was transporting tons of Kuomintang opium. Evans bristled. I took the report to Enright. He said, leave it here, forget about it. Other things came to my attention, Evans added, that proved that the CIA contributed to drug use in America. We were in constant conflict with the CIA because it was hiding its budget in ours and because CIA people were smuggling drugs into the U.S. We weren't allowed to tell, and that fostered corruption in the Bureau. Heroin smuggled by CIA people into the U.S. was channeled by mafia distributors primarily to African-American communities. Local narcotics agents then targeted disenfranchised blacks as an easy way of subduing or criminalizing them, reducing their community organizing and voting power, and thereby preserving the white ruling class's privileges. We didn't need a search warrant, explained former New Orleans narcotics chief Clarence Geruso. It allowed us to meet our quota, and it was ongoing. If I find dope on a black man, I can put him in jail for a few days. He's got no money for a lawyer, and the courts are ready to convict. There's no expectation on the jury's part that we have to make a case. So rather than go cold turkey, the addict becomes an informant, which means I can make more cases in the neighborhood, which is all we're interested in. We don't care about Carlos Marcello or the mafia. City cops have no interest in who brings dope in. That's the job of the federal agents. The establishment's race and class privileges have always been equated with national security, and FBN executives preserved the social order. Not until 1968 were black FBN agents allowed to become group supervisors and manage white agents. The war on drugs is a projection of two conditions peculiar to America. First is the institutionalized white supremacy that has defined it since slave owner Thomas Jefferson declared, "All men are created equal." Second is the policy of allowing anti-communist allies to traffic in narcotics. These deniable but official policies reinforce the belief among CIA and drug law enforcement officials that the Bill of Rights is an obstacle to national security. Blanket immunity from prosecution for bureaucrats who translate these policies into practice fosters corruption in other forms. The FBN's premier case-making agents, for example, routinely created a crime by breaking and entering, planting evidence, using illegal wiretaps, and falsifying reports. They tampered with heroin, transferred it to informants for sale, and even murdered straight agents who threatened to expose them. All of this was known at the highest level of government, and in 1965, the Treasury Department launched a corruption investigation of the FBN. Headed by Andrew Tartolino, the investigation ended in 1968 with the resignation of 32 agents and the indictment of five. That same year, the FBN was reconstructed in the Department of Justice as the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, BNDD. But as Tartolino said to me dejectedly, the job was only half done. The First Infestation. Richard Nixon was elected president based on a vow to restore law and order to America. To prove, symbolically, that it intended to keep that promise, the White House launched Operation Intercept along the Mexican border in early 1969. There were, however, unintended consequences. The massive stop-and-search operation so badly damaged relations with Mexico that National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger formed the Ad Hoc Committee on Narcotics, a.k.a. the Heroin Committee, to coordinate drug policy and prevent further diplomatic disasters. The Heroin Committee was composed of cabinet members represented by their deputies. James Ludlam represented CIA Director Richard Helms. A member of the CIA's counterintelligence staff, reporting directly to James Angleton, Ludlam had been the CIA's liaison officer to the FBN since 1962. When Kissinger set up the Heroin Committee, Ludlam recalled, the CIA certainly didn't take it seriously, because drug control wasn't part of their mission. As John Evans noted above, and as select members of Congress were aware, the CIA for years had sanctioned the heroin traffic from the Golden Triangle region of Burma, Thailand, and Laos into South Vietnam as a way of rewarding top officials for advancing U.S. policies. This reality presented the White House with a dilemma: either curtail the CIA and risk losing the war, or allow tons of heroin to be smuggled into the U.S. for use by rebellious middle-class white kids dabbling in cultural revolution. Nixon's compromise solution was to make drug law enforcement part of the CIA's mission. This decision forced the CIA to target its clients in South Vietnam. Although reluctant to do so, CIA Director Richard Helms told Ludlam, "We're going to break their rice bowls." This betrayal occurred incrementally. Fred Dick, the BNDD agent assigned to Saigon, passed the names of complicit South Vietnamese military officers and politicians to the Heroin Committee. But as Agent Dick recalled, Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker called a meeting in Saigon at which CIA Station Chief Ted Shackley appeared and explained that there was a delicate balance. What he said in effect was that no one was willing to do anything. Meanwhile, to protect its global network of drug trafficking assets, the CIA began infiltrating the BNDD and commandeering its executive management, internal security, intelligence, and foreign operations branches. This act of bureaucratic piracy required the placement of CIA officers in influential positions in every federal agency concerned with drug law enforcement. CIA officer Paul Van Marks, for example, was assigned as an assistant on narcotics control to the U.S. ambassador in France. Van Marks thereafter ensured that BNDD conspiracy cases against European traffickers did not compromise CIA operations and assets. He also vetted potential BNDD assets to make sure they were not enemy spies. The FBN had never had more than 16 agents stationed overseas, but Nixon dramatically increased funding for the BNDD, with the result that hundreds of agents were soon posted abroad. The success of these overseas agents depended entirely on CIA intelligence and cooperation, as BNDD Director John Ingersoll understood. BNDD agents soon felt the sting of CIA involvement in drug law enforcement operations within the United States. Operation Eagle was the flashpoint. Launched in 1970, Eagle targeted anti-Castro Cubans smuggling cocaine from Latin America to the Traficante crime family in Florida. Of the dozens of Cuban traffickers arrested in June, many were found to be members of Operation 40, a CIA terror organization active in the U.S., the Caribbean, Mexico, and Central and South America. Operation 40 was one of several narco-terrorist groups created, funded, and directed by the CIA. The revelation that CIA narco-terrorists were operating within the U.S. led to the assignment of CIA officers as advisors to mid-level BNDD enforcement officials, including Latin American Division Chief Jerry Strickler. CIA officers tasked to work with the enforcement division served as political cadre. Their job was not to make cases, but to protect CIA drug trafficking assets from exposure and prosecution while facilitating the recruitment of these assets as informants for the BNDD. Many of the anti-Castro Cuban exiles arrested in Operation Eagle were indeed hired by the BNDD and sent through Latin America to expand its operations. They got fantastic information, Strickler noted. But many were playing a double game. The second infestation. By 1969, Ingersoll's inspections staff had gathered enough evidence to warrant the investigation of several corrupt FBN agents who had risen to management positions in the BNDD. But Ingersoll could not investigate his top managers without subverting the organization's drug investigations. So he asked CIA Director Helms for help building a counterintelligence capacity within the BNDD. The result was Operation Twofold, in which 19 CIA officers were infiltrated into the BNDD to spy on corrupt BNDD officials. According to Chief Inspector Patrick Fuller, a corporation engaged in law enforcement hired 3 CIA officers posing as private businessmen to do the contact and interview work. CIA officer Jerry Soule, a former Operation 40 case officer, was the primary recruiter. In selecting CIA officers for Twofold, Soule chose junior officers whose careers had stalled due to the reduction of forces in Southeast Asia. Those hired were put through the BNDD's training course and assigned to spy on the BNDD's 16 regional directors. No records were kept, and some participants have never been identified. Chuck Gutenson was one of several Twofold torpedoes I interviewed. Prior to his recruitment into the BNDD, Gutenson had spent 2 years at the CIA's base in Paxe, a major heroin transit point between Laos and South Vietnam. Fuller said that when we communicated, I was to be known as Leo Adams for Los Angeles, Gutenson said. He was to be Walter DiCarlo for Washington, D.C. Gutenson's cover, however, was blown before he got to Los Angeles. Someone at headquarters was talking, and everyone knew, he recalled. About a month after I arrived, one of the agents said to me, I hear that Pat Fuller signed your credentials. Twofold existed at least until 1974 and was deemed by the Rockefeller Commission to have violated the 1947 Act, which prohibits the CIA's participation in law enforcement activities. It also, as shall be discussed later, served as a cover for clandestine CIA operations. The third infestation. The Nixon White House blamed the BNDD's failure to stop international drug trafficking on its feeble intelligence capabilities, a condition that opened the door to further CIA infiltration. In late 1970, CIA Director Helms arranged for his recently retired Chief of Continuing Intelligence, E. Drexel Godfrey, to review BNDD intelligence procedures. Among other things, Godfrey recommended that the BNDD create regional intelligence units, RIUs, and a strategic intelligence office, SIO. The RIUs were up and running by 1971, with recycled CIA officers assigned as analysts, prompting regular BNDD agents to view the RIUs with suspicion as repositories for Twofold torpedoes. The SIO was harder to implement, given its arcane function as a tool to help senior BNDD managers formulate plans and strategies in the political sphere. As SIO Director John Warner explained, we needed to understand the political climate in Thailand in order to address the problem. We needed to know what kind of protection the Thai police were affording traffickers. We were looking for an intelligence office that could deal with those sorts of issues on the ground overseas. Organizing the SIO fell to CIA officers Adrian Swain and Tom Tripodi, both of whom were infiltrated into the BNDD. In April 1971, Swain and Tripodi accompanied Ingersoll to Saigon, where they were briefed by Station Chief Ted Shackley. Swain had worked in Laos and Vietnam, and through former CIA contacts, he surreptitiously obtained maps of CIA-protected drug smuggling routes in Southeast Asia. Upon their return to the U.S., Swain and Tripodi expressed frustration that the CIA had access to people capable of providing the BNDD with additional intelligence, but these people were involved in narcotics trafficking, and the CIA did not want to identify them. Seeking a way to finesse the situation, Swain and Tripodi recommended the creation of a special operations or strategic operations staff that would function as the BNDD's own CIA, using a backdoor approach to gather intelligence in support of operations. Those operations would rely on longer-range, deep penetration, clandestine assets who remain undercover, do not appear during the course of any trial, and are recruited and directed by the special operations agents on a covert basis. The White House approved the plan in May 1971, along with a $120 million proposal for drug control, of which $50 million was earmarked for BNDD special operations. 3 weeks later, Nixon declared a war on drugs, at which point Congress responded with funding for the SIO and authorization for the extra-legal operations Swain and Tripodi envisioned. Director John Warner was given a seat on the U.S. Intelligence Board so the SIO could obtain raw intelligence from the CIA. But in return, the SIO was compelled to adopt CIA security procedures. A CIA security officer was assigned to establish the SIO's file room and computer system. Safes and steel doors were installed, and witting agents had to obtain CIA clearances. Three active-duty CIA officers were assigned to the SIO as desk officers for Europe and the Middle East, the Far East, and Latin America. Tripodi was assigned as the SIO's chief of operations. Tripodi, notably, had spent the previous 6 years in Florida with the CIA's Security Research Services, where his duties included the penetration of peace groups, as well as setting up notional private investigation firms to conduct black bag jobs. It is of historical importance that White House plumber E. Howard Hunt inherited Tripodi's Special Operations Unit, which included several of the Watergate burglars. SIO Ops Chief Tripodi liaised with the CIA on matters of mutual interest, including the covert collection of intelligence outside of routine BNDD channels. As part of his operational plan, codenamed Medusa, Tripodi proposed that SIO agents hire foreign nationals to blow up contrabandista planes while they were refueling at clandestine airstrips. Another proposal called for ambushing traffickers in America and taking their drugs and money, which, as I've reported elsewhere and in my books on the subject, case-making agents had been doing for decades, albeit unofficially. Enter Lucien Conin. The creation of the SIO coincided with the assignment of CIA officer Lucien Conin to the BNDD. As a member of the OSS, Conin had parachuted into France to form resistance cells that included Corsican smugglers. As a CIA officer, Conin in 1954 was assigned to Vietnam to organize anti-communist forces in the north, and in 1963 he achieved infamy as the intermediary between the Kennedy White House and the cabal of generals that murdered President Diem and his brother Nhu. In The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, historian Alfred McCoy alleged that in 1965, Conin arranged a truce between the CIA and the drug-trafficking Corsicans in Saigon. Conin apparently knew some of these gangsters from his work with the French resistance. The truce, according to McCoy, allowed the Corsicans to traffic in narcotics as long as they served as contact men for the CIA. The truce also endowed the Corsicans with free passage at a time when Marseille heroin labs were turning from Turkish to Southeast Asian morphine base. In a letter to McCoy's publisher, Conin denied McCoy's allegation and insisted that his meeting with the Corsicans was solely to resolve a problem caused by Daniel Ellsberg's peccadilloes with the mistress of a Corsican. It is impossible to know who is telling the truth. Ellsberg denies that his CIA friends were involved in drug trafficking. McCoy and all the evidence indicate they were. What is definitely known is that in July 1971, on Howard Hunt's recommendation, the White House hired Conin as an expert on Corsican traffickers in Southeast Asia. Conin was assigned as a consultant to the SIO's Far East Asia desk, then under CIA officer Walter Mackum, a veteran of Vietnam. Conin's activities will be discussed in greater detail. The Parallel Mechanism. In September 1971, the Heroin Committee was reorganized as the Cabinet Committee for International Narcotics Control, CCINC, under Secretary of State William Rogers. The CCINC's congressional mandate was to set policies which relate international considerations to domestic considerations. By 1975, its budget amounted to $875 million, and the war on drugs had become a boondoggle for bureaucrats. Concurrently, the CIA formed a unilateral drug unit in its operations division under Seymour Bolton. Known as the Special Assistant to the Director for the Coordination of Narcotics, Bolton directed CIA division and station chiefs in unilateral drug control operations. In doing this, Bolton worked with Ted Shackley, who in 1972 was appointed head of the CIA's Western Hemisphere Division. Bolton and Shackley had worked together in post-war Germany, as well as in anti-Castro operations, including Operation 40 in the early 1960s. Their collaboration would grease federal drug law enforcement's skid into moral and legal oblivion. Bolton screwed us, BNDD's Latin American division chief Jerry Strickler said bitterly, and so did Shackley. Bolton also screwed the judicial system by setting up a parallel mechanism using a computerized register of international drug traffickers and a CIA-staffed communications crew that intercepted calls from drug traffickers in the U.S. to their accomplices around the world. The International Narcotics Information Network, INIS, was modeled on the Phoenix Information System, PHMIS, the CIA had used to terrorize the underground resistance in South Vietnam. Bolton's staff also retooled dozens of CIA officers and slipped them into the BNDD. Several went to Lou Conin in the SIO for clandestine, highly illegal operations. Factions within the BNDD, CIA, and military were opposed to Bolton's parallel mechanism, but CIA Executive Director William Colby supported Bolton's plan to preempt the BNDD and use its agents and informants for unilateral CIA purposes. The White House also supported the plan for political purposes related to Nixon's re-election. As part of the CIA's secret government, BNDD officials who resisted were expunged. Those who cooperated were rewarded. The Bureau of Narcotics Covert Intelligence Network, BUNCIN. In September 1972, DCI Helms, then immersed in Watergate intrigues, told BNDD Director Ingersoll that the CIA had prepared files on specific drug traffickers in Miami, the Florida Keys, and the Caribbean. Helms said the CIA would provide Ingersoll with assets to pursue the traffickers and develop information on tangential targets of opportunity. The CIA would also provide operational, technical, and financial support. The result was the Bureau of Narcotics Covert Intelligence Network, BUNCIN, whose methodology reflected Tripodi's Medusa plan and included unconventional warfare tactics like provocations, inducement to desertion, creating confusion and apprehension. Some BUNCIN intelligence activities were directed against senior foreign government officials and were blamed on other government agencies or even on the intelligence services of other nations. Other BUNCIN activities were directed against American civic and political groups. BNDD officials managed BUNCIN's legal activities, while Conin at the SIO managed its extra-legal jobs. According to Conin's administrative deputy, Rich Kobakoff, BUNCIN was an experiment in how to finesse the law. The end product was intelligence, not seizures or arrests. CIA officers Robert Medel and William Loge were chosen to manage BUN-CIN operations in the field. A Bay of Pigs veteran born in Cuba, Medel was initially assigned to the twofold counterintelligence program. Medel was BUN-CIN's covert agent and recruited its agents from the anti-Castro Cuban drug smuggling underworld. All of his assets had previously worked for the CIA, and all understood that they were working for it again. Medel started running agents in March 1973 with the stated goal of penetrating the Santo Traficante organization in Florida. To this end, the BNDD's enforcement chief, Andy Tartolino, introduced Medel to Sal Caniba, a retired mafioso who'd been in business with Traficante in the 1950s. Caniba, in one day, identified the head of the Cuban side of the Traficante family, as well as its organizational structure. But the CIA refused to allow the BNDD to pursue the investigation because it had employed Traficante in its assassination attempts against Fidel Castro, and because Traficante's Operation 40 associates were performing similar functions for the CIA around the world. Medel's principal agent was Bay of Pigs veteran Guillermo Tabraue, whom the CIA paid a whopping $1,400 a week. While receiving this princely sum, Tabraue participated in the Alvarez Cruz drug smuggling ring. Medel also recruited agents from Manuel Artime's anti-Castro organization. Howard Hunt, notably, had been Artime's case officer, and many members of Artime's narco-terror organization had worked for Bolton and Shackley, while Shackley was the CIA's station chief in Miami in the early 1960s. Bill Loge was the overt agent assigned to the BUN-CIN office in Miami. A member of the CIA's jeweler program for junior officers, Loge had been Shackley's bodyguard in Saigon in 1969. From 1970 to 1971, Loge served under Tully Acampora as the CIA's special police liaison and drug coordinator in Saigon's Precinct 5. Loge was asked to join twofold, but claimed to have refused. Medel and Loge's reports were hand-delivered to BNDD headquarters via the Defense Department's classified courier service. The military was in charge of emergency planning and provided BUN-CIN agents with special communications equipment. The CIA supplied BUN-CIN's assets with forged IDs that enabled them to work for foreign governments, including Panama, Venezuela, and Costa Rica. Like the twofold canard, BUN-CIN had two agendas. The first, according to Chief Inspector Fuller, was told and had a narcotics mission. The second provided cover for the plumbers and their dirty tricks. Orders for the domestic subversive political facet emanated from the White House and passed through Conin to Gordon Liddy and his Operation Gemstone squad of anti-Castro Cuban narco-terrorists from the Artime organization. BNDD Enforcement Chief Tartolino was unhappy with the arrangement and gave Agent Ralph Frias the job of screening the anti-Castro Cubans the White House sent to the BNDD. Frias was assigned to the BNDD's International Affairs Staff. When Nixon's Chief of Staff, Bob Haldeman, sent three Cubans to the BNDD, Frias discovered they were plants who, once in possession of BNDD credentials, were to act on behalf of their political patrons at the White House. Those three were not hired, but, Frias told me, many others were successfully infiltrated inside the BNDD and other federal agencies. Under BUN-CIN cover, CIA assets reportedly kidnapped and assassinated people in Colombia and Mexico. The Nixon White House sponsors also used BUN-CIN assets to gather dirt on Democratic politicians in Key West. Thanks to the CIA, through BUN-CIN, federal drug law enforcement sank to new lows of political repression and corruption. Novo Yardley. The Nixon White House exploited the operations by committee management method to ensure political control over its illegal drug operations. As the various agencies involved in drug law enforcement pooled resources, the BNDD's narcotics mission was further diluted and diminished. As the preeminent agency in the federal government, the CIA used Bolton's parallel mechanism to commandeer the BNDD's global network of agents. The process advanced in South America when, at their introductory meeting in Mexico City in 1972, Western Hemisphere Division Chief Shackley ordered the BNDD's Latin American Division Chief Jerry Strickler to hand over all BNDD files, informant lists, and cable traffic. Bad things happened as a result, according to Strickler. The worst abuse was that the CIA allowed drug shipments into the U.S. without telling the BNDD. Individual stations allowed this, SIO Director John Warner confirmed. Insofar as evidence acquired by CIA electronic surveillance is inadmissible in court, the CIA was able to protect its controlled deliveries simply by monitoring them. The significance of this strategy cannot be overstated. The courts have terminated numerous investigations as a result of the CIA spying on traffickers. Likewise, dozens of narcotics prosecutions have been dismissed on national security grounds due to the participation of CIA assets operating in trafficking organizations around the world. Strickler knew by name which CIA people were guilty of sabotaging cases in Latin America and wanted to indict them. He brought his list to BNDD headquarters, but at Bolton's insistence, Strickler was immediately kicked out of the enforcement division. Meanwhile, CIA assets from Bolton's unilateral drug unit were kidnapping and assassinating traffickers as part of Operation Twofold. Ingersoll confirmed the existence of this covert facet of Twofold. Its purpose, he told me, was to put agents under deep cover to develop intelligence on drug trafficking from South America. The regional directors weren't aware of the program. Ingersoll said he got approval from Attorney General John Mitchell and passed the operation on to his successor, John Bartels, the first administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA. Ingersoll said the unit was not supposed to operate inside the U.S., which is why he thought it was legal. Ingersoll said he was surprised that no one from the Rockefeller Commission asked him about it. I was fortunate to interview Joseph DiGennaro, a member of this covert operation. Joey DiGennaro's entry into the covert facet of Twofold began when a family friend, who knew Jim Ludlam, suggested that he apply for a job with the BNDD. Then working as a stockbroker in New York, DiGennaro met Chief Inspector Fuller in 1971 in Washington. Fuller gave DiGennaro the code name Novo Yardley, based on his posting in New York and as a play on the name of the famous codebreaker. After DiGennaro obtained the required clearances, he and several other recruits were spun off from Twofold into the CIA's operational unit. The background check took 14 months, during which time he received intensive combat and tradecraft training. In October 1972, DiGennaro was assigned to a New York City enforcement group as a cover for his CIA activities. His paychecks came from BNDD funds, but the program was reimbursed by the CIA through the Bureau of Mines. The program was authorized by the appropriate congressional committee. DiGennaro's unit was a component of the Special Operations Division, which at the time was managed by former Phoenix Program Director Evan Parker. The U.S. military provided assets within foreign military services to keep exfiltration routes, air corridors, and roads open. The military cleared airspace when captured drug trafficking suspects were brought into the U.S. DiGennaro spent most of his time in South America, but the unit operated worldwide, including in Lebanon, France, and the Far East. The unit numbered about 40 men, including experts in printing, forgery, maritime operations, and telecommunications. DiGennaro would check with Fuller and take sick time or annual leave to go on missions. There were lots of missions. As his BNDD group supervisor in New York, Joseph Carecchio said, "Joey was never in the office." The job involved tracking, kidnapping, and if they resisted, killing traffickers. Kidnapped persons were incapacitated by drugs and dumped in the U.S. As DEA agent Jerry Carey recalled, "We get a call that there was a present waiting for us on the corner of 116th Street and 6th Avenue. We'd go there and find some guy who'd been indicted in the Eastern District of New York, handcuffed to a telephone pole. We'd take him to a safe house for questioning and, if possible, turn him into an informer. Sometimes we'd have him in custody for months. But what did he know? If you're a Corsican drug dealer in Argentina, and men with police credentials arrest you, how do you know it's a CIA operation? DiGennaro's last operation in 1977 involved the recovery of a satellite that had fallen into a drug dealer's hands. Such was the extent of the CIA's parallel mechanism. The Dirty Dozen. With the formation of the DEA in July 1973, BUNCIN was renamed the DEA Clandestine Operations Network, DECON. A number of DECONs were developed and funded as special field intelligence programs. As an extension of BUNCIN, DECON 1 developed intelligence on traffickers in Costa Rica, Ohio, and New Jersey, politicians in Florida, terrorists and gunrunners, the sale of boats and helicopters to Cuba, and the venerable Traficante organization. Under DEA boss John Bartels, administrative control of the DECONs fell under DEA intelligence chief George Belk and his assistant for special projects, Phil Smith. Through Belk and Smith, the Office of Special Projects became a major facet of Bolton's parallel mechanism. It housed the DEA's air wing, staffed largely by CIA officers, conducted research programs with the CIA, provided state-of-the-art technical aids and false documentation to agents, and handled fugitive searches. As part of DECON 1, Smith sent covert agent Bob Medell to Caracas and Bogota to develop a network of agents. As Smith noted in a memorandum, reimbursement for Medell is being made in back-channel fashion to CIA under payments to other agencies and is not counted as the position against us. Thoroughly suborned by the CIA, DEA Administrator Bartels established a priority on foreign clandestine narcotics collection. Thus, when Belk proposed a special operations group in the Office of Intelligence, Bartels immediately approved it. In March 1974, Belk assigned the special operations group to Lou Black Luigi Conin. As chief of the Intelligence Group Operations, IGO, Conin administered the DEA's Special Operations Group, DEA-SOG, and its National Intelligence Officers, NIO, program. The chain of command, however, was unclear, and while Medell reported administratively to Smith at Special Projects, Conin directed him through a separate chain of command, reaching to William Colby, who had risen to the rank of CIA director in the summer of 1973, concurrent with the formation of the DEA. Conin had worked for Colby in Vietnam, and through Colby's personnel assistant, Jack A. Matthews, he hired a dirty dozen CIA officers to staff DEA-SOG. As NIOs, not regular DEA agents, the DEA-SOG crew did not buy narcotics or appear